For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello everyone, and welcome to a History of Egypt podcast interview episode. My guest today is Dr. Chris Naunton, Egyptologist, writer, and broadcaster. Dr. Naunton served as the director, CEO, of the Egypt Exploration Society from 2012 to 2016. He was also the elected president of the International Association of Egyptologists from 2015 to 2019. Alongside these significant career accomplishments, Dr. Naunton has published two books, Searching for the Lost Tombs of Egypt in 2018 and Egyptologist Notebooks, coming September 2020. His research interests include the history of archaeology and Egyptology as a science, and the history of the 25th or Kushite dynasty, a line of pharaohs whose deeds are a fascinating part of Egyptian history. Recently, Dr. Naunton has been hosting a series of online lectures for the Egypt Exploration Society. Among other topics, he covers the history of Akhenaten's city, Amarna, as an ancient community and as an archaeological site, one where many generations have worked to uncover the past. When I saw this, I immediately reached out to him on Twitter, and we were able to organize this discussion about Amarna, its people, and the many areas in which Dr. Naunton is expert. It is a fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoy. So, good morning, Chris. Thank you very much for joining us, and welcome to the History of Egypt podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure, really. Thanks for the invitation.
That's great. And how are you doing in London at the moment?
We are okay, I think. Thanks. Yeah. I mean, I can't speak for all, whatever we are, 9 million people in the capital. Right where I am, which is pretty central in Kensington, things are quiet on the streets. But actually, supermarket shelves are well stocked. We're lucky; we've got very nice parks nearby. So long as everybody's maintaining the social distancing measures, we're doing okay. Yeah. So actually, I feel as though the anxiety of the early lockdown has passed somewhat. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I say that as somebody who's lucky enough to be healthy, and all my loved ones are healthy too. So I realize that.
Yes.
Much as I'm sort of saying, oh, you know, everything's okay, there's a lot of people who are not in that fortunate position around here. So, yeah,
absolutely.
Mixed feelings.
Mm. So as part of your, well, let's call it your coping mechanism, you've been giving some online lectures for the Egypt Exploration Society. And one of the ones that you've been talking about recently, and the one that stimulated me to get in contact, was your series about the history of Amarna, and in particular, scholars' exploration of the city in the past, say, centuries.
Yeah.
Right out the gate, I wanted to touch on something that you brought up in one of your lectures, which I thought was really interesting, is, broadly speaking, from your research, what was the kind of public awareness of Amarna and Akhenaten specifically prior to the early 20th century? So we've known about Akhenaten for about 100 years now, at least, thanks to his colossal statues. But what was the public awareness of him before that?
Good question. So by the middle of the 19th century, there was an awareness that something very unusual centering on Amarna had happened, and that this occurred sometime in the later 18th dynasty. So there was some awareness of the key players, Akhenaten in particular, although that reading of his name, Akhenaten, is more recent. He was still known as Huenaten at the end of the 19th century into the 20th. I honestly don't know at what point that changed. But yeah, there was an awareness that part of the strangeness of this period was a brand new sort of artistic style and way of depicting the world, which largely derived from what people could observe in the decorated tombs at the Amarna, the North and South tombs. Those were first, as far as we can tell, visited by Westerners, European travelers, scholars in the 1820s, and they were sort of fairly comprehensively recorded by certainly by the time of the Lepsius expedition in the 1840s. So the scholarly world by this point had an awareness of the sort of outline of the history, and the you know this sort of outlandish change in the artistic style, and that this had taken place at this, as I say, at this particular point in the later 18th dynasty. You mentioned the colossal statues actually at Karnak, which I think are significant because the decoration that we have in the tombs at Amarna is clearly unusual and it clearly falls outside the normal canon of Egyptian art. But the most outrageously different images we have from the Amarna period, I think it's fair to say, are the ones that come from Karnak, those colossal statues of Akhenaten, possibly also of Nefertiti, although that's not confirmed. Anyway, those are the most unusual images, and those weren't discovered until the 1920s. I suppose the other thing that's worth mentioning from around that sort of time as well is that, you know, if we have one single iconic image of Akhenaten, it's probably the colossal statues, and if we have one single iconic image of Nefertiti, it's the bust that's now in the Ägyptisches Museum in Berlin, and that wasn't discovered until 1912. So there was certainly by the time of Lepsius himself was aware that something unusual had happened, and that, you know, part of that was this dramatic transformation in the way the world was depicted in two and three dimensions. But those very iconic images didn't come to light until the early part of the 20th century.
Right. And similar to that, what were the, say, the most prevailing theories about the artistic style in the 1800s? Was there an explanation for it?
I don't know that I don't know that there was a kind of a definite idea. I mean, I think already by this point the possibility that these were realistic depictions of Akhenaten, at least, and Akhenaten even in the tombs is the most prominent figure. That, you know, possibly this is what he really looked like. So even setting aside those really unusual images that we get from Karnak, he's always shown with very broad hips, with kind of a sagging paunch and breasts, and to a certain extent, the sort of elongated face. And there would already have been images of the royal princesses, for example, with the strangely sort of elongated heads. I mean, there was already a feeling, I think, in the 19th century that this was attributable to some kind of medical condition. And those, I think it's fair to say now that those sorts of theories have gone away. But there, I mean, I'm sure there are still some people that would like to read something of that into the evidence. And the other sort of way of looking at it is just that this was an attempt to deliberately to make a move away, a break from what was otherwise clearly a very rigid, formulaic way of depicting the human form and the rest of the world. And you know that maybe there was something purely sort of artistic in this. It's also worth saying as well that it was clear to scholars from the very earliest time, from the 1820s, people like Gardner Wilkinson and James Burton observed this, that part of the story of the art was the disappearance of all gods but the sun. The sun god, the sun disk. And so there were already they were already making the connection between a new set of religious beliefs and what they were seeing in the art. I'm not sure they had dramatically different ideas about that from the ones that we have now. I think probably scholarly opinion on that's moved, but the general ideas about what this might be attributable to are all still there, I think.
You mentioned Gardner Wilkinson, and that's a name that many people today might be unaware of, but John Gardner Wilkinson is possibly one of the forgotten heroes of early Egyptology. You know, everyone knows Champollion or Howard Carter or Flinders Petrie, but not many people necessarily know Wilkinson. Can you introduce us to this chap a little bit and recount the contributions he made to Amarna studies specifically and just Egyptology generally?
Sure. So John Gardner Wilkinson he went to Egypt for the first time in the around about 1820. He came from a sort of unremarkable background. He was educated, he's an Englishman, he was educated at Harrow School, just outside London. He had a very good education. Even at an early age, while he was at school, he'd taken an interest in the ancient world and in Egypt. And at this time, the race to decipher hieroglyphs was very much an important part of sort of international scholarship in the humanities. It was one of the most sort of eye-catching scholarly endeavors around, this quest, which was being led in the UK by Thomas Young, and in France by Jean-François Champollion at this point. And their efforts to understand Egyptian language were kind of reaching the great culmination at the point at which Gardner Wilkinson was ready to think about traveling. He did a university degree. I think he was at Cambridge, if I remember rightly. And he subsequently traveled. He met with a guy called Sir William Gell, who was a kind of all-round scholar, polymath in the humanities, who was also not really contributing to the decipherment particularly, but very much in touch with people like Thomas Young and keeping a close eye on it. And with Gell's encouragement, Gardner Wilkinson eventually made the journey to Egypt around the time of the Champollion's announcement of his system of decipherment. And Gardner Wilkinson went to Egypt and along with a whole series of other people who would end up making a significant contribution to Egyptology, but he in many ways was the most successful of those, at least among the British. He stayed in Egypt for longer than most of the others, and he was doing what a lot of others were doing, which is embedding himself in the country, dressing as a local, or specifically as a Turk, and adopting the local dress, familiarizing himself with the language and customs, the modern language, that is. He built himself a house on the West Bank in Thebes in Sheikh Abdul Gona, and he set about studying the sites and monuments as much as he could, and making copious notes and drawings and doing little bits and pieces of excavation here and there. And that actually is what a fair number of people were doing at the time. Robert Hay, James Burton, Edward William Lane, Henry Salt to some extent, William John Banks. And on the French side, there are a few scholars as well, Frederick Caillot, and eventually Champollion and his retinue as well, who were all out there, like I say, studying the monuments and also making copies. And they were doing this by the mid 1820s, armed with some sense of how to read the inscriptions, which was new. Gardner Wilkinson, in some ways, was the sort of leader among them, other than Champollion, in that his knowledge of the language, not just the ancient language, which he knew thanks to Champollion and Young's efforts, but also Coptic. Gardner Wilkinson had become very familiar with Coptic as well, which was Champollion's way into understanding hieroglyphs and ancient Egyptian as well. He'd armed himself with a great linguistic knowledge, but he was a kind of all-rounder and went up and down the country visiting sites, including lots of places that weren't really very well known, including Amarna. And so he, when he by the time he went there, the site was always already recognized as a significant place archaeologically. The Napoleon's savants had visited and made a sort of sketch plan. Well, it's not even really wasn't even really that, but they'd made a site plan of sorts, which at least recorded that there was some significant archaeological remains there. Gardner Wilkinson did the same. And made a plan of the remains in what we now call the central city, the central part of Akhenaten and Nefertiti's new capital. And his the Napoleonic the savants map is really it doesn't show very much more than the position of the river, the position of the road, and then records that there were some buildings around. Gardner Wilkinson goes much further. His map shows a recognizable outline of several of the main structures in the central city, particularly the Great Aten Temple, but also the smaller Aten Temple, the King's House, the Great Palace, the Royal Road. So he had recognized the outline of the most important buildings, and it's Gardner Wilkinson who apparently was the first person to visit the North Tombs. We learned that they were unknown. I mean, this seems impossible, really, but they were apparently unknown to the locals. So he is the first person to have any knowledge of those tombs, and it's the tombs that are decorated with this great Amarna style. And so it's Gardner Wilkinson who's sort of the key to this. He let his friend and colleague James Burton know about it, and Burton passed the knowledge on to Robert Hay, and Gardner Wilkinson himself made some drawings at Amarna, but actually Burton and particularly Hay were better copyists, and they both made among the first good records of the decoration in the tombs. So really, thanks to Gardner Wilkinson, Amarna. Knowledge of what was at Amarna and that there was something very special there moved forward very rapidly. In more general terms, sorry, this is a very long answer.
That's fine.
In more general terms, Gardner Wilkinson became certainly in later years the most important, greatest, if that's the right way of putting it. British Egyptologist of the early to mid part of the 19th century. He was, as I mentioned, second to only to Champollion, at least in the 1820s and until the time of Lepsius, the sort of second best scholar of the language. But contrary to his British colleagues, Gardner Wilkinson published. So he published a guide to the antiquities of Thebes and elsewhere, which, although it from the title it sounds like a sort of Lonely Planet or a rough guide or something, but it was actually one of the first, approaching scientific surveys of sites and monuments, and very important in that way. And he made some incredibly good and detailed maps of, for example, the West Bank. In Thebes, his sketch plan of Amarna is not so detailed. His Theban plan is incredible. And he also published a three-volume work, which he called The Manners and Customs of the Ancient Egyptians, which was really a kind of survey of everything that was known up until this point about ancient Egypt. And that went into numerous editions and was very widely read. And for that reason, he became hugely influential in helping the wider scholarly and wider public communities, certainly in Britain, but elsewhere as well, familiarize themselves with what was known about ancient Egypt. Robert Hay and James Burton and others might have made similar contributions, but they never got their act together and published. So they amassed huge quantities of very, very good documentation, better than Gardner Wilkinson's. But they perhaps weren't on his level as scholars, and he published, and that's key and has been key ever since.
That's very good, very thorough. I like that. Thank you.
Yeah, so a very long answer. Sorry, everyone's gone home by now.
That's excellent. That's excellent. You mentioned earlier, which I thought was very surprising, the idea that even the locals of Amarna weren't aware of the North Tombs seems almost impossible to imagine.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of the things which is important to remember about, all of the sort of so-called discoveries, if you like, of people like Gardner Wilkinson, is that, what were discoveries to them were often of sites and monuments which were very well known to the locals. Yes. And the story of the development of Egyptology through people like Gardner Wilkinson and all these other people I've mentioned journeying to Egypt and making records of what they saw is in large part a story of some foreign people making the journey to a very foreign, very different place. I choose the word foreign very carefully, very, very kind of alien place, and negotiating the local people and landscape and customs and way of doing things. And that wasn't always an easy process. It was a kind of process of exchange. One of the things that is really interesting to me in the research I've been doing for a book on this kind of thing just lately is that there seems to have been a very pretty well-trod route for all of the people coming from Europe into Egypt at that point. So, you go there by sea, you sail, you land at Alexandria, you have a look round, you've got your classical accounts with you. As time goes on, you might have the accounts of other travelers with you, although those weren't available to the very earliest people, of course. You have a look around, you observe sort of fallen obelisks and columns and the fact that the place seems generally to have fallen into ruin. You don't stay for very long. You make the journey across the delta. You might think this is noteworthy. A lot of them didn't really. You arrive in Cairo, and you then spend quite a long time in Cairo, familiarizing yourself with the local people and the customs, and also meeting any sort of fellow countrymen who might be over there and who might be able to help you. And from the time of Napoleon's invasion onwards, there are significant numbers of Europeans in Cairo who can help you with things like, where do you buy clothes? And, rather unhappily for us in more modern times, where do you find your slave girls? And how do you get your permits? Because you need a permit to travel. You can't just go willy-nilly gadding about the country. You probably go to meet the British vice consul. If you're British, you go and meet the French vice consul. If you're French, you might meet them both if you're lucky enough. And then another thing is you get yourself a dragoman, an interpreter who will help you with the language and also fend off any unsavory types who might come your way, and you get a boat, and so it's sort of partly to do with archaeology and observation and science, and it's also partly to do with cultural exchange and Yeah, that's a I feel that's the sort of slightly untold story of how, how we come to do Egyptology today. You mentioned that actually earlier, to a certain extent, lucky old Egyptologists can do what they do in the lockdown easily enough from a desk or from a library. But there was a time when there was no such thing, and the only way of, of knowing about this stuff was to be there.
Yes.
And you had to be pretty intrepid to go and do it as well. It was a intimidating and difficult and potentially sort of life-threatening thing to do, to go and make a journey to somewhere so alien. So they're very impressive people, adventurers as much as scientists, some of these early people.
We have much more conversation with Dr. Naunton still to come. After the break, we dive deeper into the history of Amarna, the excavation and exploration of the city, and in Egyptology generally. We also cover Chris's upcoming book, Egyptologists' Notebooks. For now, it's time for a quick breather. See you in a moment.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
So you mentioned that you're working on a new book, and as part of this research, you've been looking at, sort of lesser known sources, in particular notebooks from the people who visited and explored and documented Egypt during the 1800s. Some of these sources almost naturally are going to include drawings or records of sites and monuments that have subsequently been damaged or even destroyed.
Yeah.
So, while doing this research, what kinds of things did you uncover, particularly regarding Amarna and the monuments and people there that relate to these sort of lost images and lost monuments?
Oh, that's interesting. That's maybe the single most interesting part of the research from a purely Egyptological perspective, is, to cut a long story short, just how much of the archaeology of Egypt, which had survived down until the early 19th century, say, was then lost in the decades following that. So it's difficult from the point of view of, us Egyptologists cannot bear the idea of a single scrap of what might be information or evidence about the ancient past being lost, right? I mean, it's unconscionable to think that anything could be lost. And when you read the very earliest accounts of visits to, say, Saqqara, seems to have been a good, Saqqara seems to have been the place where people got to kind of explore underground grottos and catacombs and things. And, these were filmed with mummies, and the mummies were covered with, one guy, George Sandy, says something like covered with all manner of strange designs and hieroglyphical characters and this sort of thing. And you can, these things are not identifiable. Saqqara is identifiable. But beyond that, none of the details are identifiable. All we know is that this guy was able to just walk up to the site, go straight into what are clearly were presumably a high status rock cut tombs, and observe ancient burials in, some degree of preservation with no protection whatsoever. And in some cases, the travelers sort of imply that, they walked off with a souvenir
a trinket.
And again, we've no way of identifying what this material was, and we've no way of knowing whether it survived or, you know, and is in a museum collection now somewhere, or whether it was, you know, completely lost. We have no idea. In a different sort of sense, the Napoleonic expeditions, Description de l'Egypte, is incredibly important, because they were able to document sites and monuments which, even within a couple of decades, had gone. So entire temples at sites like Antinoopolis, Antiopolis, Elephantine, there's a small temple of Amenhotep III which was dismantled, Amant, Hermonthis. There's a whole sequence of what were at that time well preserved monuments, which were either lost to natural causes, or more often than not, just quarried for their stone, because Egypt was building very rapidly at this point, and temples were there, ready sources of stone, and so they were just dismantled. As incredible as that seems. If nothing else, that, you know, the early records are just crucial for that sort of thing. At Amarna, sorry to come back to your the main thrust of your question, Amarna actually has survived pretty well, incredibly. I mean, I think that's probably largely because so much of our information, so much of the information that we have now, you know, in 2020, comes from the excavations of the city. And the information that we've gained vastly outweighs the sort of pretty things element of what's in the central city. So you know, in those early days, people were mainly interested in, I don't know, pretty or unusual or exotic things. They wouldn't have been so concerned with mud brick walls and potsherds, or, you know, indecipherable cuneiform tablets or whatever, you know, which might be absolutely crucial for history, but, you know, no interest if you can't read them, or, you know, they don't look nice. Having said that, the one part of Amarna which we can clearly demonstrate has suffered is the tombs. I talked a little bit in the lecture I did the other day about the history of exploration at Amarna, about a particular tomb, the tomb of Meri Ra II, where there is a scene of a king and queen, which, you know, we might, with no other evidence, we would just assume was Akhenaten and Nefertiti. And in that regard, it wouldn't, if that was true, it wouldn't be unusual, because we've got lots of depictions of Akhenaten and Nefertiti all over the place at Amarna.
Sure.
But the inscriptions next to this pair reveal that, in fact, it's not Akhenaten and Nefertiti. It's a sort of shadowy pharaoh called Smenkhare, and the great royal wife is Akhenaten's daughter, Merit-Aten. We only know that from the inscriptions, which were certainly present when Robert Hay copied them in the 1820s, 1827, I think, and when Lepsius visited in the 1840s. But by the time the Englishman Norman de Garis Davis visited in the early 20th century, those inscriptions had completely disappeared. So, you know, if they disappeared before Lepsius or Hay or anybody got there, we'd have no knowledge that this was not Akhenaten. And you know, if you know your Amarna period Egyptology, you'll know that you know, the existence of this other Amarna pharaoh has generated more sort of speculation and theorizing about what happened during this interesting period than almost anything else. So, you know, it fortunately in this case, although the physical stuff has gone, we at least have the documentation, but what other things we might have lost, even as recently as the last couple of centuries, is you know, a depressing and scary thought.
And that's something that I try to emphasize on the podcast, is just how fragmentary so many of these records actually are, and how easily entire individuals or years or even a decades can slip through the cracks just by the nature of preservation.
Yeah, absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right to do that. I can only sort of say quite right. I think sometimes the way histories are written, any sort of any stuff is written about ancient Egypt, I feel as though a lot of the time the text needs to be reminding people a bit more often that you know there are really huge gaps in what we know. I prefer myself to always try and give the reader or the audience some sense of what the evidence is, so as to show that, you know, even those of us who pretend to be experts are really only making a sort of best guess based on what we have available, but fully in the knowledge that, you know, when a new piece of evidence comes to light next week, we'll be shown to be completely wrong.
incidentally, the example of Smenkhkare is extremely important, because if that tomb image had disappeared just a few years or days before the first copy was made, we might almost to this day, or for at least a long time, have had very little idea that this person actually existed. I mean, now we have things like rings and references from Amarna and other sites, but for a long time, that was the only record of this Smenkhkare. So,
yeah,
it's very fortunate.
Yeah, absolutely right. And in fact, I'm not sure I mentioned it in the people at Amarna talk, but I've just done another one just actually today on another aspect of Amarna history, and I talk in that about the fact that for a very long time, until very recently, it was still being argued that Nefertiti, Akhenaten's great royal wife, had disappeared off the scene a couple of years before his death, and then in when was it, 2011 or sometime around then?
Around that.
So very recently, an inscription of basically the very end of Akhenaten's lifetime, mentioning Nefertiti right there at his side, just turns up. You know, and had been there all along. It's just nobody had spotted it before, and suddenly Nefertiti's back. You know, there can be no argument now that she disappeared, and that means all the arguments about why she disappeared. Did she die? Did, you know, did she fall from favor? Was she replaced? Did she start to take on a different identity? All of those theories and all of that, everything that was written about that, disappears. It's great.
Yeah, it's very useful. And our mental note to insert a little caption there, because by the time this interview goes out, I will have dealt with that particular graffito and the conundrums that I've resolved. So fortuitous timing. Good mentioning.
Great.
In episode 131, we covered the later years of Queen Nefertiti. In that episode, we discussed the old idea that the queen had died or lost favor in the second half of Akhenaten's reign. Recent evidence has refuted that. A graffito carved in year 16 of Akhenaten identifies Nefertiti as the ruling king's wife. In other words, Nefertiti did not die or lose favor. The evidence just had a gap. Now, we know that she survived and thrived. And this graffito is a good example of how Egyptian history changes, sometimes in major ways, with every new discovery.
So, getting back on track a little bit, the book you're working on right now, titled Egyptologist's Notebooks, sort of, first of all, it digs beneath the surface level histories of Egyptology as a science and starts going into, you know, the primary documents of many individuals who were working and participating in research. And one of the angles, whether this was intentional or just a effect, is that it sort of sets out to right some historical wrongs and give proper spotlight to people who, for one reason or another, have kind of faded into the background. Out of curiosity, from your research, is there a particular figure that you feel deserves far greater recognition or fame than they eventually received?
Oh, well, it's difficult to pick one. I've got to say it's difficult to pick one. I think the character, the individual in the book who will be the least known to anyone, I think, is a guy called Hassan Hosni, who was an inspector at Abydos, or in the Sohag Inspectorate, in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. He had trained with Ahmed Kemal Pasha, the kind of instigator of Egyptology in the Egyptian community in the later 19th century. Ahmed Kemal had founded a school of Egyptology for Egyptians because, by the way, because the French-led Antiquities Service had made it very clear that Egyptians should not be studying Egyptology. So there was, this is no secret, you know, there was that horrendous side of things in the later 19th century. So Hassan Hosni had studied, I think actually Ahmed Kemal had a couple of goes at establishing a school of Egyptology, and Hassan Hosni was in the second wave, the second school. He became quite influential in the Antiquity Service in the Sohag region. And we still don't know very much about him. We know a lot more about him as of the last couple of years because a huge archive of administrative documents relating to the Antiquity Service in the local inspectorates has come to light as of about 2012, I think-ish.
Oh, my goodness.
In a storeroom in the Seti Temple at Abydos. Completely forgotten, unknown. Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. Just to look at the archive is unbelievable because it's thousands and thousands of bits of paper that are, most of which are still tied up in bundles, you know, and not unwrapped, not looked at all. But Hassan Hosni's activities are much better understood as a result of some of the documents that the Egyptian project, which is now working on these papers, has started to read. And to cut a long story short, it's clear that he was much more the boss, for example, of his British counterparts. And the Brits who were in the employ of the Antiquities Service, certainly by the 1820s, then would generally have been understood to have been the way up until now. So the hope is that this archive and others like it, and they must be out there, they just haven't really been accessible and studied to the extent that they might be yet. But the hope is that they will help us to understand much better the dynamic between Egyptian Egyptologists and foreign Egyptologists at that relatively early stage. So, to go back to your original question, it was entirely deliberate on my part that there should be a kind of some new thoughts about the way that we understand the history of Egyptology. And this is not the book to write, you know, to put everything right, not by any means. And I dare say some people at the harder end of the revisionist way of looking at things will probably find it's a disappointing book. But what I wanted to do, again, cut a long story short, is I wanted to have more Egyptian voices in there, and I wanted to have more women in there than have generally been represented. I also, in general, wanted to get away from the so-called great man narrative, which basically has Egyptology dominated by directors of projects and the great scholars. So, you know, typically the names that have survived and the names that we know best and the most celebrated are the names of the people who ultimately took all the credit for archaeological work. And they were the field directors. They were the ones whose names went onto the publications. And it's difficult, I think, to overstate how important it is to be the one whose name is on the front of the book. In terms of, you know, people's understanding of the, you know, relative importance of everybody. If your name's not on the book, then you know, you don't survive in the literature and you're quickly forgotten. And again, I tried to restore some of those sort of forgotten figures to their their place in the story. It's like I say, it's not the book to right all the wrongs, but I've done my best.
Very good. Well, someone has to start somewhere. They can't.
Well, it's kind of you to say, I hope it's a small contribution. Yeah.
So, speaking of great man narratives, which God forbid I try to avoid in the podcast as much as possible, but is still a problem. Yeah. It's easy to think of somebody like Sir William Flinders Petrie as this kind of lone titan in his field, you know, the only one who was doing things in a scientifically robust way. But as you've just indicated, you know, this isn't strictly accurate. Petrie is more of an overseer of an organization rather than a lone field worker. And he's, you know, when you start digging into his records, he's actually flitting between several sites at the same time, where he has huge teams of workmen excavating with their leaders, their rays, bringing him the notable finds.
Yeah.
So first of all, there's that whole organizational aspect that is often minimized when it comes time to report these things. Even if the person themselves, you know, made an effort to acknowledge those contributions over time, those details get lost. On the more personal level, there are very significant contributions that other people moving in the orbit of men like Petrie and his colleagues, there are other people making important contributions that deserve to be acknowledged. And can you introduce us to one or two of them?
Yeah, sure. Another aspect, I suppose, of this is that Egyptology is it's quite a snobbish academic discipline.
Yes.
And scientific publication for some people, you know, the only important thing. But there are other ways of going about making records, and like I say, I mean, I think it's very difficult to overstate the importance of publication, and the idea that if you don't do it, you're much less likely not to be appreciated. A couple of the people in the book are not really Egyptologists in that they're not scholars, but that's not to say that their experiences and the records they made aren't extremely valuable. So somebody who springs to mind is Marianne Brocklehurst, who is a woman traveling with her female companion, with whom she spent her life, traveling around to various places, but to Egypt on a number of occasions. And she had no particular interest in making a kind of scholarly contribution to things. She just enjoyed the country. She liked being there. She loved the monuments. She kept a diary. She made some of which we reproduce in the book. And she made some drawings, again, not sort of scientific drawings, in that she wasn't trying to capture with scientific accuracy what she was seeing. But, her impressions of things and her records of the people she met, you know, whether she meant to or not, can be a huge contribution to Egyptology. So, for example, she talks often about meeting Mustafa Aga, who was a sort of local bigwig in Luxor. He lived in the Luxor temple. One of the last people to do so before it was cleared by Maspero. He was somebody who, when you went to Luxor, and we know this thanks to Marianne Brocklehurst, also Amelia Edwards, they traveled more or less together for when they first went to Egypt. Incidentally, they weren't going there deliberately together, but they arrived at the same time and sort of traveled on separate boats,
right?
Almost racing each other down the Nile. Mustafa Aga is somebody that you went to visit, and he was a dealer, as well as being a local sort of facilitator and, you know, influential person who could get you this and that. He was also brokering deals in antiquities, and Marianne Brocklehurst and Amelia Edwards both bought things there. And so he's an important player in the landscape who we know a little bit better thanks to them. Marianne Brocklehurst also, this is one of my favourite things in the book, just by sheer luck, happened to be at Deir al-Bahari at the time of the discovery of the coffins of the priests of Amun of the 21st dynasty, this the so-called Bab el-Ghassus discovery. And she made two drawings of the removal of the coffins. Again, you know, they're not sort of photographically accurate, or, you know, they're not scientific. We know we couldn't learn too much about individual priests from the coffins, but just as a visual snapshot of what's turned out to be one of the most significant discoveries ever made in Egypt. It's amazing to have that kind of record. You know, so I'm glad that she's in there. Who else could I pick? Luigi Vassalli, maybe. He was an Italian who sort of had twin careers, one as a political dissident in Italy and campaigner for Italian independence, which got him into some scrapes. He sort of flits between his loyalty to the cause in Italy and working as an archaeologist in Egypt, in the employ of Mariette. So he's one of a whole series of people who did Mariette's excavations for him. He was kind of ahead of his time in that Mariette's very celebrated as the discoverer of this, that, and the other, and the founder of the Antiquity Service, the founder of the present day Egyptian museum collection. But he excavated like a crazy person, and the documentation was very poor, but Vassalli actually did a very good job, and documented some material, for example a whole series of coffins that he excavated at Thebes, and his documentation is very good, and in some cases those coffins have disappeared, but we're able to say something about the owners, and in fact we're able to say a little bit about second intermediate period chronology thanks to his records. So, I mean, he's somebody who in Egyptological circles is reasonably well known. There was a very good piece of research done on his records actually a few years ago by a friend and colleague of mine, Francesco Tiradritti, but he's still not, I mean, anywhere near as well known as Mariette. This reminds me actually of one last, if I may just have one last character, this reminds me of another of these excavators who was working on behalf of somebody who's become more celebrated. I mentioned the British and French vice consuls who were operating in Egypt in the sort of second and third decades of the 19th century in particular. Henry Salt was the British vice consul. The French vice consul was actually an Italian, a guy called Bernardino Drovetti. They competed with one another, as I'm sure you know, to excavate you know, fantastic pieces, and it's their excavations really that start the great plundering of Egypt, the great sort of rush for gathering of antiquities, and their collections make up the bulk of the big things, statues, columns, whole bits of temples and things that are now at the centre of the collections in London, in the British Museum, in Paris, in the Louvre, in Turin to some extent, and in Florence as well. Those are the sort of big early collections. But actually, the excavations were being done by other people. They were being done for Salt and for Drovetti, but by other people. Belzoni was famously excavating for Salt, for the British. Slightly less well known, at least in the English-speaking world, I think, is a guy called Jean-Jacques Riffo, who did a lot of the excavations for Drovetti, particularly in places like Karnak. And if you visit the sculpture gallery in the Louvre, in the Egyptian section of the Louvre, you'll see some huge and fantastic pieces. Also in Turin, similarly in the Gallery of Kings, for example, in the Turin Museum. So the very famous statue of Ramesses II as a young man seated with the blue crown, with his arms crossed like this, that was excavated for Drovetti by Jean-Jacques Riffo, who did all this, you know, did all this work. Not terribly well, and he left behind some records, some drawings, but they're quite honestly, I even, maybe it's mean of me to say this, they're mostly terrible. he's somebody who made for better or worse, a huge contribution in that he excavated massive areas and he excavated huge things. So he's, I mean, he's very significant. I think it's a bit of a shame that when you go to the Louvre, his name's not mentioned and his story's not told, because several of those huge things in the Louvre and in Turin, like I say, something as famous as that statue of Ramesses II, which is one of the great pieces of statuary from ancient Egypt. His story is not known very well, I think. So, yeah.
Fair enough. Yes. Well, hopefully get around to telling all of those stories at the end of the podcast, maybe in about 5 or 10 years, but we'll see.
We now come towards the last section of the interview. Dr. Naunton and I dive into his career and what brought him to Egyptology. We will also explore the questions he hopes will be answered in the future, and what we might learn about ancient lives. That is after the music. Back in a second.
So, moving now to your work as an Egyptologist and as a professional of every stripe, you had the privilege of leading the Egypt Exploration Society for 4 years.
Yeah.
And also of being a contributing member to the society for about 16 years total. I'm curious to know what it was.
Yeah. Sorry, say again.
I'm curious to know what it was like leading that society and what did it actually involve?
Oof. Yes, you're right. So I worked there for almost 16 years. I've been a member for 20 this year. Ah. And so I was the director for the last, it was almost five actually, 5 years. But before that, I had been the deputy director for 4 years. So what did it involve? The Egypt Exploration Society was founded by Amelia Edwards in 1882 as a way of funding an explorer, to use the term that was in use at the time, to go to Egypt to do some digging. That was the sort of early form of a foreign institution carrying out scientific research through excavation at archaeological sites in Egypt. And in that way, it helped set a template that is still in existence today. And indeed, the ES is still doing this. So it provided the funding through what we would now call crowdfunding. Basically, Amelia Edwards was a genius at whipping up support among the public, and she, you know, essentially she had a big public audience herself. She was a novelist and an artist and travel writer, and so she was very well connected and was able to say, look, you know, Egypt's terribly interesting, and the sites and monuments are being destroyed. We've got to do something about this. We've got to send somebody out there to excavate and document things before they're lost forever. And that's really what the ES is still doing 130 odd years later. So my role there was not, although I have an Egyptological background and I was there because, you know, I was an Egyptologist of sorts. I was originally there, incidentally, to run the library and to do basically to do some sort of junior administrative work. I was at the beginning of what I was hoping would be a career, and I was very, very happy to take any old job any old where in Egyptology. But I was running the library, so that's where I could use my Egyptology skills, helping people with research and helping to organize the collection. I came to work on the archives a little bit later, and basically I hung around long enough that eventually they made me the boss, and so
there was nobody else left.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just hung around to the point where I was the oldest person there. So, you know, we're going to have to let me have the job. It involved The EES is a charity. It's a UK registered charity. So that you know, we have, the society has certain responsibilities in that way. There was a lot of fundraising to do, and the EES then and now did that mainly through members' subscriptions and donations. So we ran a public program of activities to generate support and generate funds. And then, you know, on the other side of things, I was in charge of, I guess, in charge of trying to manage how all of that was spent. And, you know, and a lot of that money goes to Egypt, to archaeological research. The society's got an office in Cairo with a member of staff in. They run a program of activities out there, education and training activities. So, I mean, I was having to, you know, to try to make sure that we could fund projects and try to make sure that we were funding projects that our supporters would be wanting to support. And so I guess it was balancing those sort of two things, you know, making sure we can bring the money in and spend the money properly on Egyptological research in Egypt. But you can imagine, in amongst all of that, there was a good deal of basic sort of management and administration to do. You know, I spent a lot of my time managing a team of staff in London and Cairo, managing field directors and publications program and library and archives, and then trying to make the numbers add up as well. I did a lot of work on budgeting and finance management as well. So you know, it was all very good experience and I enjoyed it. But there came a point where I really wanted to get back to doing more purely Egyptological stuff, and so that's why eventually I took the decision to go my own way.
Was that the lure of research knocking at the door again?
Yeah, it was. I had a book that I was under contract to write that was going nowhere, and that's the Searching for the Lost Tombs book. I had been lucky enough to be able to do a bit of TV work while I was at the ES, but I wasn't able to do as much as I would have liked. So I left it to try and reduce the amount of administration and management I was doing in favor of doing more writing and TV work and research. And although I wasn't really planning this, I have ended up doing a lot more writing, TV research. That was in the plan, but also going to Egypt, leading tours. That was not something that was in my plan, but it's been fab. It's enabled me to spend much more time in Egypt than I did before, which has been really great.
So out of curiosity, what would you, looking back on your time leading the EES, is there anything that stands out as something really significant that you learned from being a leader of that kind of organization, whether on a personal or professional level?
Wow. I should say straight away that I learned a huge amount about just people, managing people. I think it's fair to say that when I became the director of the ES, I had fairly clear ideas about what I wanted to do, and I just assumed that what would happen is that I would tell people that this is what I wanted to happen and they would do it. I didn't really realize that it doesn't always work like that, and you know, it's a process of negotiation and you know, sort of engendering a consensus view, and having to, you know, I mean it sounds obvious if you've ever done it, but you know, I hadn't at the time. I hadn't realized that management is all about kind of herding cats, and you know, by cats I mean sort of people with different personalities and different motivations and different ideas about how things should be done, and your job is to just make the best of that. But it, you know, it's not a walk in the park. It doesn't always go how you want it to. There's a lot of compromise involved, and you know, you've just got to make the best of the situation and try not to sweat the small stuff. I don't know, this sounds like a whole load of cliches, but in the process I learned a lot about myself as well, because I learned what I was when I, you know, in that sort of in that kind of work, I learned what I was good at and not so good at, and what I was comfortable with and not so comfortable with. So I grew a huge amount in that time. I think it was an enormous learning process, I realized that up until the point at which I became director, I had pretty much been left to my own devices at the ES, and that was great because I could sort of make my job up. And when I became the director, I was responsible for my own work, but more importantly, for the work of everybody else as well. That meant controlling everything much more, was much more difficult. And that, you know, there's good and bad about that.
Mm. Speaking of herding cats and also Amana earlier, it just made me wonder, if you could sit down and talk with Akhenaten about that process. I wonder what his perspective would be on it.
Well, you know, by way of an answer to that, I think I would just say that one thing which causes us to remember that just how fragmentary our evidence is, like you were saying earlier, is that we have got to be honest with ourselves and say that we've got absolutely no idea what somebody like Akhenaten was really like, mm-hmm. And what he was really thinking. So I find that scenario you've just sort of suggested, you know, really super interesting, if only for that reason that it just causes you to realize that if you were told that, you know, you're about to get in a time machine, which is also going to take you to the central city at Amana, and it's going to take you to the royal palace, and you will be given sort of 5 minutes or so to straighten your tie and have a glass of water, but then you're going to go and meet Akhenaten, I'd have, nobody would have the faintest idea what that was actually going to be like. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know if he was really intimidating and serious and angry and narcissistic and awful, or whether he was lovely and funny and quiet and shy. And we just don't know. And the evidence gives us a, first of all, very fragmented, as you said, picture from these little scraps. We have to try and build the picture, and our, you know, naturally our brains lead us towards creating a more fully realized picture than the evidence really supports. And as for what I would ask, I'd sort of want to know, you know, what were you thinking? You know, what did you, where's this all going? But I'd want to find out if he was the kind of person that was just going to want to punch my lights out, or just a really interesting kind of guy that I would really get on with, you know. So I'd start off with some stupid small talk, probably.
I love your work.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Who's Ankeperu Ray, Mary Nefekeperu Ray, Nefer Neferu Atten, Mary Watin Ray? Is it your wife?
Yeah. So you've been working at the forefront of sort of public awareness projects in Egyptology, particularly in the last few years, as you say, since you left your leadership role at the EES. And one of the things you seem to have been focusing on is helping to raise the profile of the Egyptological science and its visibility in general consciousness. From your perspective, looking at sort of Egyptology overall, not just your own contribution, what do you think are some of the noteworthy successes that Egyptologists have had that you've witnessed in the past 20 years in terms of public outreach?
Ooh, wow. Well, I think in general terms, most Egyptologists are aware of and bought into the idea that while academic research is what provides the sort of credibility, and for most people, I think that's a sort of indispensable part of being a proper Egyptologist or a real Egyptologist, you know. And again, I mean, it's a terribly snobbish discipline, and I'm not sure that this is appropriate or not. But for most people, you know, the academic research is sort of indispensable. And yet, at the same time, translating that research for a wider audience, for a public audience, is also indispensable. That probably applies to a slightly smaller proportion. And I think, you know, everybody is, it's in the nature of academic research that it's obscure for the most part. And so it's up to Egyptologists to try and find ways to make what they their little obscure bit of Egyptology relevant to wider audiences. I suppose in the last 20 years, just off the top of my head, things that really stand out are, maybe I'm a bit biased here, but I think, you know, the idea that Nefertiti became pharaoh, and that we can demonstrate this through, we can try and demonstrate this. We can make a case for this, at least through very close scrutiny of the material from the tomb of Tutankhamun, which is very well known and very appealing and attractive for people. I think that's a great success. And that's largely the work of Nicholas Reeves, Aidan Dodson and others. It's made its way into TV things, which I've been involved in, but I've very much just been the messenger, not the sort of creator of those ideas. And others as well. You're right. I think also the idea, whether you like it or not, that there are hidden chambers behind the walls in the tomb of Tutankhamun is a fascinating idea. It remains a fascinating idea, and I thought that the way that Nicholas Reeves went about that was great. I'm an admirer of his, as you can probably tell. Sure. I think Manfred Bitek's discovery at Tel Adaba, I think actually this is maybe slightly longer ago than 10 years, but he certainly published it more recently, of the so-called Minoan frescoes, which he argues betray a Cretan influence on Egyptian art in the early 18th dynasty is probably not had quite as wide an appeal and an impact, but I think that's very significant. Again, whether or not it's really taken hold in the public conscience, I think probably the single most important kind of new area for research in Egyptology in the last 20 years, perhaps, is the geo-archaeological work of people like Angus Graham, Judith Bunbury, and others, Jamie Woodward, basically looking at the phenomenon of Nile movement and how this will have affected the survival of archaeological remains. It will have affected the development of the built environment throughout Egyptian history. There was almost no awareness of that at all. There was some awareness, but it was really very specialist before sort of 20 years ago. And that is just about in the sort of wider public consciousness now. And at least in the conversations I have with people sort of recognize and, you know, are ready to ask the questions about this site or that site. You know, is it closer or further away from the river than it would have been in ancient times? And that, you know, that just that idea that that's possible and it's had that impact, I think, is really important. Is that good enough? Is that good enough?
That's very thorough. Yeah, it's good. I like it. on the flip side, well, not really the flip side, but the next step is, what kind of outreach would you particularly like to see Egyptologists, or let's just say historians of Egypt and scientists generally, sort of prioritize, which maybe isn't getting as much publicity as it should in 2020?
I think that there is still a lot more that specialists in Egyptology could be doing to disseminate their ideas online. I mean, it was one of the things that this has been bothering me for a long time, actually. When I was at the ES, including when I was at the ES, I'm still actually amazed. The longer it goes on, I'm amazed that there's not more blogging among archaeologists and Egyptologists. I suspect that this is because any available time for writing has to go into writing that can be rewarded with you know, accreditation or whatever, the kinds of things that university departments need for research assessment exercises. But I know I'm not alone in thinking that in the future, you know, it would be good if writing could be sort of spread across very, very short form. And I include things like Twitter and Instagram in that. Sort of mid form, which might be blogging, and then long form, which might be books, along with scientific reports. One of the things, and this is a whole big discussion, one of the things that I spent a lot of time thinking about when I was the director of the ES was the fact that the ES had a backlog of unpublished scientific data and was committed to publishing it in basically in print format. And the ES, to cut a long story short, at the time I was there, didn't really have the money to publish it all. And part of the story of that was that there just wasn't the demand for it, and so in other words, the economics of it didn't work, and that gave me a headache for some time. And it, to be honest, but the time I left the ES, I didn't really feel as though I'd been able to resolve it. My feeling is that probably there needs to be more weight towards a way of writing and a way of circulating information which makes it accessible to people in bigger numbers. I am surprised that fewer, or rather I'm surprised that not more Egyptologists and archaeologists working in Egypt have made use of social media and blogging. I say that as somebody who does quite a lot of social media and not as much blogging as I probably should do, but, you know, at least I feel as though I know how it works. I do not do anything like Snapchat or TikTok or vlogging. Do you even call it that, or vlogging? I'm sounding as old as I am now. I don't do these things, and I'm sort of waiting for the, you know, a younger generation of Egyptologists. Maybe you're it, Dominic, to come along and knock everybody else, all of us dinosaurs, out of the water by making much better use of the platforms that are out there. So, yeah, who knows? I mean, actually, one other thing I should say on that is that the lockdown is already very interesting in this way, I think, in that the demand, you know, in for things like online lectures and other, you know, online stuff is it seems very healthy to me, and I can see myself beyond the lockdown continuing to do online lectures as a sort of indispensable part of what I do. I'd never given one until about 2 or 3 weeks ago, but it seems like a very good thing to be doing. I do wonder to what extent actually the lockdown, you know, might have tempted, for want of a less jargony way of putting it, content creators, and that would be Egyptologists in this case, might have tempted them into doing things online in the way that I've been, you know, tempted into doing online lectures here. And it might well tempt an audience into consuming that content online in a way that they haven't before, and, you know, and that might just have the effect of nudging Egyptology forwards in that way.
So one thing that my listeners may not know is that you lead a variety of different tours. You've mentioned Egypt, but you also go to Sudan and Ethiopia as well, which is actually a lot more important for Egyptology than people might generally realize. So what sort of experiences have you enjoyed on those tours, and what kind of insights have those experiences given you as a scholar?
Good question. I should say Ethiopia is a new tour, and it hasn't run yet. It booked out very quickly, so that's a good sign. But you're right, yeah. Sudan has been somewhere I've been with the same company that I go to Egypt with, and so that means this to a large extent the same kind of travelers. And you're absolutely right that these countries, Sudan and Ethiopia and other places too, are very important And it's sort of an important part of, you know, understanding the world and the ancient past. In the case of Sudan, the connection with Egypt is very clear in that the territory that is now modern day Sudan was inhabited by the ancient culture of Egypt for considerable periods of time. And the Egyptians, you know, built monuments and left aspects of their culture in those places. And so, you know, if you're interested in Egyptian sites and monuments, then, you know, you can go and see Egyptian sites and monuments over the border in Sudan. But that also offers the opportunity for visitors to understand that Egypt was in that time, in those times, operating in somebody else's country, and there were other people living there who were not Egyptian, and the Egyptians were foreign invaders, and the indigenous peoples had a culture and a way of life and doing things of their own. And that those two sets of peoples, well, actually multiple sets of peoples, you know, had a mutual influence on one another, and that dynamic between cultures in the Nile Valley, and we think of mainly, you know, we think of Egypt first and foremost, I suppose, and that's at least partly a sort of accident of modern. The way the modern world is developed and the science of Egyptology is developed, we think of Egypt first and foremost. Secondly, we might think of the Kingdom of Kush, which was the civilization that inhabited the Middle Nile Valley, the Sudanese part, for much of ancient history. And for much of that time, Kush was as powerful as Egypt and at times was able to invade Egypt, and for a brief period of a century or so, between very roughly 750 to 650 BC, Kush took Egypt over and ruled Egypt as a line of pharaohs, the 25th dynasty. I think understanding the dynamics between those two groups of people and their varying motivations and cultural exchange between the two, I think understanding those processes from a sort of the perspective of, you know, people as we are interested in ancient history and archaeology, is very instructive and I think helps potentially an understanding of the way the modern world works with you know, travel and cultural exchange and, you know, expansionism and territorial grabs and that sort of thing. And what happens when people from different places with different ways of doing things mix, and you know, in all that means for good and for bad, so Sudan was a very natural extension of this particular Egyptologist's interest in the ancient world and in territory, but actually Ethiopia is as well. You know, if you've got an interest in Kush, I have. My PhD actually was on that period I was just talking about, of the 25th dynasty. And Kush, even after the 25th dynasty, after they had retreated from Egypt, the Kushite kingdom continued to thrive in Sudan for many centuries, for the best part of 1,000 years. It was only eventually supplanted in its heartland by a powerful kingdom called Aksum, whose heartland was in Ethiopia, and then the center of that civilization is in modern day Ethiopia, and there's now a lot to learn from going there, and that's why we've decided to plan a trip around that. It's really, in some ways, it's for people who have made the journey with us through, you know, Egyptian sites and monuments, through Sudanese sites and monuments, and, you know, now making that journey as well. And that also allows us, I think, to reflect on the way in which we Egyptologists in the modern Western world understand the ancient past in those places, because we're in some sense repeating some aspects of the journey up the Nile. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought that you cannot, you know, get a, well, no, sorry, put this different way. An understanding of ancient Egypt is really massively enhanced by going to Egypt in the modern day. And I think the more time anybody who's interested in the ancient past in that part of the world can spend in that part of the world in modern times, you know, the better. And that goes for not just Egypt, but, you know, for Sudan and Ethiopia and beyond as well.
Yes, good answer. I'll have to join the Ethiopia tour when it comes up available next.
Yes,
that'd so, be great. On the personal level now, just you as a person, what first drew you to Egypt as an interest, and what led you to choose Egyptology as a potential career?
I've had a lot of opportunities to think about this, actually, because I get asked quite a lot, and the answer is still I don't really know how it all started, to be quite honest. I just remember what I've taken to saying is that I remember that when a TV documentary series called The Face of Tutankhamun was aired on the BBC in what I now know is 1992, which is when I would have been 14. I knew then that I was already sort of hooked, and that was a big deal in our household at home. My mum and me certainly would have made a big point of sitting down to watch that. And you know, I was interested in other things that 14-year-olds are interested in as well. But that was definitely already there then. I just don't know how far back the interest goes. I can't really remember. I was always interested in history, and I did history and I did classics at school. And I do remember that there was a point when I was at school where I told my history teacher in a lesson. We had a friendly relationship, and I'm still in touch with him today. But I told him that, you know, I'd much rather be studying the ancient past than the Tudors or whatever we were doing. And I remember that moment, but I don't remember really what was behind it. And it was I think it was a casual kind of interest as well, because I was most interested at that sort of age in rock music and football. So if I'd been good enough to play for Arsenal, then I probably would have done that. And if I'd been the kind of person that would have ended up in a rock band, then I would have done that. But instead, I went to university to study ancient history and archaeology, again with not a bit feeling a bit directionless. But I basically got to the University of Birmingham, which I chose partly because Egypt was a component part of the degree in ancient history and archaeology, and I was, you know, that seemed good to me, and I just loved it. As soon as I got there, I loved every bit about it. I loved everything I was studying: Roman Britain, European prehistory, classics and classical archaeology, medieval cathedrals, and Egypt and the Near East. And of all those things that I loved doing, the thing that I decided I was going to focus on was Egypt. And I was only ever treating it like, you know, I'll do this for as long as I can make it last, and then I'll go and do something serious when inevitably I have to. So I did okay in that degree, and I was encouraged to carry on and do a master's degree, which I did. And I was going to do a PhD, but my supervisor said, look, we think you should go away and just have a normal life for a bit and maybe try and get some work experience. During that time, I did try and get myself some work experience, and I did manage to get myself onto a dig in Egypt at Abydos, working with Joseph Wegner, who was excavating the temple town of Senusret the Third at that time. I spent a month drawing pottery in the very, very, very oppressive heat of the desert. It's a great experience, but not entirely happy minute by minute.
It's the trial.
And I also just applied for every job going in what I thought was a year off in between a master's and a PhD, and with no expectation I was going to get anywhere near getting a job. And that's when I got a job at the EES as librarian and membership secretary. And then I was in, and I loved it. I just loved it. And I always thought, and I still do think that I'm, you know, weeks away from having to go and do something else, because it'll all come crashing down. And I started working for the ES in 2001, so that'll be 20 years next year that I've been employed in some sense in Egyptology, and still going. So but yeah, I never really had a great career plan or anything. I think the one thing is that I've always tried to make sure that I'm enjoying it. So I think, if I'm really honest, I think some people thought it was a bit of an odd thing for me to do, to leave the EES and stop being director after just short of 5 years to go and be self-employed. You know, why give up that job? But the thing was that I felt like the point of all of this was to carry on immersing myself in reading and writing about ancient Egypt, and I wasn't able to do that as much as I wanted to at the ES, so I left.
Yeah, understandable. Well, congratulations on nearly 20 years and for another few weeks of being able to do this professionally.
Yeah, I hope so. Yep, you'll just have to delete the podcast if it turns out that I end up going off to do something else.
we'll excise you from history, just like Akhenaten. So one final question, and this is something that I ask every person that I interview, and it sort of gives a sense of their interests and also their personality.
I can't hear you.
I'll redo that. Okay. So one last question, and this is something that I ask of everyone who comes on the show, and it sort of gives a sense of their interests, but also their personality. Ooh. Is if you could answer one question or one issue definitively from ancient Egyptian history. So if you could clearly identify one thing with 100% certainty, what would you choose and why?
I can think of lots of things, but I would like to know when the kingdom of Kush was able to establish itself power over the south of Egypt, and whether this happened under the Kushite king Kashtar, or
I'm
whether
not sure
it
if
happened
you can
under
hear me,
his successor Pienki,
and
what happened. If I could go back in time and see it, I would love to see that king arriving in Thebes.
You actually just dropped out there for about 20 seconds. Ironically, just as you began your answer, the internet froze. If we can just start again from the beginning of your answer.
So there are lots of things that I can think of, but I think I'm going to go for I'd like to know at what point the kingdom of Kush took over the south of Egypt as far as Thebes, at the beginning of the period that would become the 25th dynasty. I would like to know whether this happened under the Kushite king Kashtar, or whether it happened under his successor Pienki, and I'd love to know how it happened. So if I could rent a hotel room in Thebes, secure hotel room with a good view out over the Nile, and see the Kushites arriving and what they have to do in order to establish themselves, I'd love to see that, because we don't know what happened. We just know that there was a certain point at which they were in charge. And I have often thought about this. Yeah, it'd be great to know that.
That's a good answer. So, Chris, Dr. Naunton, that brings me to the end of my questions. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us on the History of Egypt podcast. I apologize. I've kept you far longer than I promised to do so, and I hope you're not too sleepy. I hope you've enjoyed yourself, and I hope you'll consider visiting again when the podcast narrative reaches the 25th dynasty, and we can talk in much greater detail about the topic that you've spent a long time researching very thoroughly.
I would love to do that. Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. I'll hold you to that. I'd love to.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, and take care.
Thank you. You too.
My special thanks to Dr. Naunton for joining us for this interview. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Naunton and his work, follow the links in the episode description. There are a couple of webinars that he presented on Zoom for the Egypt Exploration Society, and also a link to his website where you can find a lot more information. That's all from me. I'll be back next week. See you soon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.